Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs here at Princeton University. Today, my colleague and co-host Sam can't be with us, but it's a pleasure to talk with everyone. One of the most important stories in contemporary American history, which we keep learning about and reading about, has to do with the civil rights movement in the 1950s and early 1960s that culminated with the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It's looked back upon as really an important moment where social movements work in conjunction with some politicians to achieve real social change. And I think it's often a point where we look back to in part because of our current frustration in trying to get legislation passed and some of the concerns we have today about what effect social movements can have on our political leaders. And obviously, it's a story of the ongoing struggle in the United States to deal with the issue of race. Today, we have with us Stephen Levinston, who is an editor at the Washington Post. He edits the book reviews, the nonfiction book reviews at the Outlook section. And he is also the author of a terrific new book, Kennedy and King, The President, The Pastor, and The Battle Over Civil Rights, which has recently been published by Hatchet. Stephen is also the author of Little Demon in the City of Light and The Kennedy Baby, The Loss That Transformed JFK. And before The Washington Post, he worked for The Wall Street Journal, The International Herald Tribune, and several other publications. Stephen, thanks so much for joining our show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, maybe we can just start with why you decided to focus on the relationship between President John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King as the way that you wanted to tell this story of civil rights.
Well, the book really focuses on the evolution of President Kennedy on civil rights. I wanted to look into why he evolved from a president who really came into office not as an advocate for civil rights, but really more concerned about his social and political agenda on taxes and unemployment and those sorts of things, and how he evolved from that into the president that we sometimes call the first civil rights president in the United States. That evolution took place really over 2.5 years, from 1961 to June of 1963. And so what I tried to do is to try to understand how a president evolves in office, what changes a president can go through during his time in office. And it seems to me that this has become more relevant than ever as we move into our current administration, because it's so important for a president to sort of grow and mature once they come into office. And the more I looked into the issue, everywhere I looked, Martin Luther King popped up. Martin Luther King really, in my study of the civil rights movement and of Kennedy's presidency, was really instrumental in guiding President Kennedy towards sort of a moral awakening on civil rights that came, you know, very slowly, but eventually it came. I mean, so much so that a lot of people these days think of Kennedy as a civil rights president, and many African Americans had in their homes three pictures on the wall. One was Martin Luther King, one was Jesus Christ, and the third was John F. Kennedy. And the three were all mixed in the psyche of the African-American community. But it was a very difficult and long process that Kennedy went through to get to that point.
And when he comes into office, different writers have different takes on this. Was Kennedy someone who was opposed to civil rights legislation, indifferent to civil rights legislation, or was he someone who didn't see a way in which civil rights legislation would ever get through a Congress that was then dominated by Southern Democrats?
Now, I think it was a little bit of all three of those. And depending on the situation, he would draw on either one of those. You know, he didn't see the possibility of civil rights legislation getting passed because of the power of Southern segregationist senators in Congress. He also didn't want to have to fight them because he wanted their support for his other the other parts of his domestic agenda. So he sort of took, you would say, an ambivalent view on civil rights for most of his term, and tried to sort of skirt around it and turn it, you know, more into an issue of law and order. If there were trouble on the streets, he wanted to keep peace, but he didn't really want to push hard on legislation until very late.
And what did most civil rights leaders think of him? Obviously, the movement's taken form by this time. So how did they see John F. Kennedy as a president?
Well, early on, I think they saw him as a ditherer, unwilling to move fast enough, unwilling to listen to their calls for equality. You know, whenever they had a new protest movement of some sort, say the freedom rides with the buses, Kennedy showed a little bit of interest, but then he would quickly back away. Again, he was more interested in just not allowing unrest to sweep through the streets so that it became a talking point in the Cold War, where if we had unrest in the streets, it was an opportunity for the Soviet Union and Nikita Khrushchev to say that the American democratic system is too messy to be really a superior political system.
And then how did Martin Luther King, turning to him, you describe him as someone who's much more more of a moral visionary than a politically calculating person. How did he try to sell civil rights, not simply to activists, African-Americans, and even white Americans in the South, but how did he try to describe and shape the issue to political leaders so that he could change someone like John F. Kennedy?
Well, I do think he emphasized the moral aspect of civil rights. He was constantly hammering away at that issue, and he had a lot of moral authority. He felt that if only he could prick the conscience of the people who really made the decisions, and those people were mostly in the White House, and get them to understand that there was long-term problem with segregation and discrimination in the country, that's the only way that he could get anything to happen. Early on in the movement, he favored the more, you know, nonviolent political protest, and it served him well very early in his career during the Montgomery bus boycott. But then into the 60s, it kind of faltered a bit, and it didn't have the sway that it had earlier on. And so he had to up his game a little bit as we moved from 61, 62, and into 63, where he became a lot more aggressive in a way to sort of shake Kennedy's tree a little bit more.
And the Montgomery campaign was very important to King's evolution.
The Montgomery bus boycott?
Yes, yes.
Well, that basically made his name. He was a very young preacher at the time, and the boycott began. He was not really the leader at the time, but they were looking for someone to lead it. They turned to him, and he, you know, was questioning himself whether it was his time, whether he should do this. He stepped back one evening and talked to God. He prayed. He thought about it, and he decided this was something he had to do. And then he went full bore into it. And over the next year, that movement was remarkably successful in dealing with segregation in Montgomery. And he became a star, basically, a real stellar figure in the civil rights movement that, you know, blasts him into the stratosphere that he almost has today.
And one of the things about King that's always interesting that he talks about and he writes about is the challenge of incrementalism, or the challenge of waiting. And he'll talk obviously about the fierce urgency of now. He'll write explicitly on how incrementalism is a problem for the civil rights movement. Can you talk about what that meant for a Martin Luther King and how it relates to his relationship with Kennedy?
Well, I think that's an important point, because as we know, the Black community had waited a long time for change in civil rights, and there had been lots of efforts through the years, and nothing really had happened. If anything had happened, it had been incremental. And Kennedy, you know, King's, you know, one of his favorite ideas was that it had to happen now. And he sort of also was working against his father in that regard, who was a big preacher at the time, and who also was of the older school that we should take an incremental approach to this. So we can take time, we can use the courts, we can move slowly. King might have subscribed a little bit to that early in his career, but as he grew and the movement grew stronger, and he realized that the community was no longer as patient as it used to be, the approach had to be faster and stronger and quicker. He blasted Kennedy throughout those first couple years for what he called tokenism. Kennedy would take small steps, very incremental steps, but he wouldn't really take the major steps that King wanted him to do. For a while, he wanted him to sign a second Emancipation Proclamation, which with one stroke of the pen, it was believed Kennedy could do away with much of the discrimination and segregation that existed in the country and avoid legislation. But Kennedy refused to do that. And, you know, this created a lot of the friction between the two men and sort of helped to color their complicated relationship.
And what's interesting, too, is that in trying to push that idea and trying to get that message across, I was looking for the section where there were limits to what he could do in the media, that he tries newspapers and magazines, but in the end, it's not so effective, King finds. And that's part of why the turn to collective protest is so important. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, he spent a lot of time trying to talk to Kennedy and talk to the administration through the media. I mean, they met a few times, several times, really. But he spent his time trying to tell the president in interviews, in his own writings, what needed to be done. But those were easy to ignore, really, from the president's point of view. He could hear it. Maybe some of it soaked in. And my belief is that stuff did soak in gradually over time and did help to transform Kennedy's view of what needed to be done in civil rights. But you're absolutely right. What needed to be done was really to stir up the streets and to make sure that Kennedy saw that the people were ready and that there might be danger on the streets if Kennedy didn't act.
And when do they first meet?
They first met actually before the 1960 election, when Kennedy tried to sway King to his side. It was kind of a very stiff, uncomfortable meeting. Kennedy called it because he felt that he wasn't getting enough black support going into the election. And he needed what he thought were black leaders to help sway the black population. It was sort of a mistaken view in the view of black leaders like King and Harry Belafonte that blacks really didn't need to be swayed by their leaders. They had their own views and they would come to their own decisions on what political leaders were about. But nonetheless, the political view from the Kennedy camp was that he had to talk King into being on his side, possibly even endorsing him. So they had a meeting and Kennedy tried to convince him of his bona fides in civil rights, but King was not impressed entirely. He thought that Kennedy still had a lot to learn. He maybe was leaning the right direction, understood some things, but he was far from where the civil rights movement would want him to be at that point. And in any case, he was not one who endorsed any political candidate because that diminished his overall power.
Hey, did you find some historians argue that one of the reasons civil rights emerges as an issue, there was someone named Mary Dudziak who wrote a book on this, was the Cold War actually stimulated concern for civil rights, meaning that American leaders were aware of how racial conflict in the U.S., Little Rock and other incidents were being used by the Soviets as propaganda. And there were also all these accounts of leaders from Africa who are here in the United States and subject to racism, and that actually stimulates people in the State Department and elsewhere, including Kennedy, to take a more proactive role on civil rights, as much as the protests here in the U.S. But my sense from your book was that wasn't as clear with Kennedy, that there was a disconnect with his fervor for fighting the Cold War from his early, at least, positions on civil rights.
Well, no, not entirely. I mean, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, that he was always conscious of how the civil rights movement and how unrest mostly played out in the U.S. and how it was exploited by the Soviet Union. There are several instances in the book where he's concerned about that. In particular, I think it was during the Freedom bus rides, mm-hmm. where there was a lot of problems with there was a bus burned in Anniston. There was a riot in Montgomery, and this was at a time when Kennedy was trying to make his way in the global stage and to confront Khrushchev, but he had this in the background, and he knew that this was not a profitable program for him if he wanted to make points with the Soviet Union.
And so, one way in which your book tells the story is Kennedy gradually being persuaded, morally persuaded, by the movement, by King. Do his political calculations change in the course of his presidency? Meaning, by 62 and 63, are there more political incentives also pushing him towards civil rights than there had been in 1960? Or is this really a moral transformation of a leader?
I think it's just hugely complicated. I think it's a mix of many different things. It is politics. It is personal. But the politics were shifting. I mean, there were Gallup polls later in 63 that were showing that the American public was now more disposed towards doing something about civil rights in a way that they hadn't been in 60, 61, 62. So he probably began to feel that there was some room politically to do what he needed to do or what he might want to do. But at the same time, my emphasis and my interest really is in Kennedy as a man, as a man who tries to grow. It's like any of us, as we develop, we all want to improve. We want to become better people. And even though someone like Kennedy and even King as well are these icons who we sort of mythologize and think they're almost superhuman, and they're not really human in the sense that we are, they were subjected to the same impulses and the same desires that any of us are. And I try to sort of chart some of that in the book. You know, what were the pressures on Kennedy as a human being that were sort of forcing him to address his conscience, to grow, to look at how he could be a more mature president and man. And there were some interesting examples.
Did King worry in the Birmingham campaign in 1963, which is probably the most iconic for students of civil rights, did King worry as he's trying to persuade Kennedy, members of Congress, the media, about the use of children, for example, in the protest, that the images would turn the other way if he wasn't careful? How did he deal with those concerns?
Those were a very big concern. And they were not only a concern of his, but they were the concern of the black community in Birmingham that gave King a lot of trouble over taking that route. But again, he knew at that point that something dramatic had to be done, that in essence, the Birmingham campaign was not the great campaign everybody thought it was from the beginning. It was staggering early on. It was not getting the media attention that the movement and that King wanted. And that had to be addressed. One way to do that was putting children into the streets. And King's argument was that young people have always been significant in driving any moral cause and any civil rights cause. And so he kind of convinced himself that perhaps we could abide this under that understanding. And so he allowed it and he went with it. Earlier on, before that, so in some ways, the more dramatic moment for him was whether he himself would march and get himself arrested. That was a little bit before the children's march. And there was concern at that time that the Birmingham movement was flagging. They had a lot of people in jail, but they weren't getting the publicity they wanted. They were running out of money to post bond and bail for all those people. And the feeling was that King was great at raising money, and he could raise money that would be helpful to the cause, because they had an obligation to all these people who had been arrested marching in Birmingham. But at the same time, he also had an obligation to put himself out on the street and face the same problems of jailing that others felt. And so, again, he went like he did in Montgomery in the very beginning of his career. He retreated into a back room and prayed a little bit, thought it over, and then changed his clothes and came out in some very unusual looking clothes that he never wore. He took off his dark suit and came out in blue jeans and a work shirt and decided to go on the march. And that's when he went out and marched and defied an injunction against that and wound up in the Birmingham jail.
And you talk about how after the Birmingham marches, King is – he emerges from this as a movement celebrity, a political celebrity, and he uses that. He's speaking all around the country. You talk about Hollywood celebrities want to shake his hand. And at each speech, he's really using that opportunity to build pressure on the president. So strategically, he really capitalizes on the months after Birmingham as a way to change the way the president thinks of the issue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, he was a star before. His star started to fade a little bit. And then after Birmingham, he shone all the more brightly. And he certainly used it. And he also used it to raise a lot of money for the campaign as well.
And Kennedy, though, still is hesitant, even after that.
He's hesitant. He's worried. He, you know, after, you know, Birmingham, this is when he actually made his great speech on June 11th, 1963, where he did talk about civil rights as a moral issue, that we had a moral crisis in the country that had to be dealt with. And he decided that he was going to introduce legislation, what King had always wanted and many others had wanted. And King responded with, you know, a very powerful telegram to the president saying what a wonderful speech it was. But he immediately became concerned, as his brother did, on getting legislation through the Congress because there was still resistance. And that sort of mounted as the movement put together their march on Washington for August of later that year.
And then you have a great little section after the march on Washington and King's famous I Have a Dream speech. You write, in the Oval Office, President Kennedy watched with total absorption. He had never been inside a church when Martin Luther King was on the pulpit. He had never sat through an entire King speech. He had never witnessed the rolling cadence and rhythm in its fullness. The preacher had dazzled the president. Turning to his aide, Lee White, Kennedy was in awe. "He's damn good," he said. Robert Kennedy later seconded that, marveling, "Boy, he made a hell of a speech." President Kennedy was a man who had hit rhetorical highs himself, and he appreciated eloquence. He knew he had just seen the performance of For the Ages.
Oh, yeah.
So a speech like that can have an impact on a president.
I think so, especially on a president like John Kennedy. And there was another aspect of that speech, too, which is kind of an interesting Kennedy-era thing in the sense that Kennedy didn't watch it, you know, on the mall. He saw it on television. And it sort of showed you the power of that small box as well, which I think Kennedy in some way was responding to at the same time, because he knew how great he was on television, and he was able to master that television medium. And there he was seeing Martin Luther King through the small screen, also mastering that medium, and also realizing that this was a communal experience for the entire nation. That sure, there were people out there on the mall, 200,000 or whatever it was out there, but there were people across the country who were having this experience together because of that new medium.
And that would be true. Obviously, this is outside the scope of your book. With the voting, the Selma marches were in part effective because of how people saw them on television. And there's a lot of Lyndon Johnson officials, including Richard Goodwin, the speechwriter, who remember watching it. And that's part of how the impact happened back in the Oval Office.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and Kennedy, I mean, Kennedy really was our first television president, too. You know, I mean, he understood the medium in a way that previous politicians had never. Previous politicians were still a little suspicious of it, and they didn't look so good on TV, so they didn't want to go on it as much. But, I mean, here was this charming guy, and he certainly knew how to use the medium, and he used it, you know, better than anybody before him.
And did the moments – you've talked now a lot about the persuasive parts of their relationship. Were there moments of greater tension where King was more frustrated openly with the president about the way this transformation was taking place over years while the crisis was unfolding on a daily basis for African Americans?
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of that and a lot of tension. I think one, you know, good example of that was in was during the Freedom Rides, when we had great violence in one of the terminal in Montgomery. And at the end of that day, the Freedom Riders, who had been beaten and bloodied, retreated to a church. And there were a good 500 to 1,000 parishioners who also went to this church. And they all gathered in the church with King and other ministers who were going to have a kind of a prayer meeting. And the church became surrounded by a mob outside so that the people inside simply could not get out. And this was a very dangerous. I mean, this was a real crisis moment in the movement, really. And King was on the phone with Robert Kennedy for most of the night, trying to make sure that the parishioners inside would be safe. Kennedy was sort of, this is Robert Kennedy acting on behalf of his brother, who basically, again, at this time was in the background and was letting his brother be the heavy and handle most of the highly public dealings with King and the movement. But there was a lot of tension all through that night, and they wanted marshals, they wanted other military to move in, and some did, some of the marshals moved in, but it was a period of incredible tension that fortunately worked out okay in the end. The crowd did not storm the church as some of them tried to, but the parishioners were locked in basically all night and couldn't leave until the morning.
So how did you decide? A lot of writing on civil rights has moved away from Martin Luther King and more toward the activists and other leaders in the movement that they who were often overshadowed by King. And yet, you know, your book puts King front and center again in understanding what was happening. I don't know if this was a conscious decision or how you thought about how to structure the narrative, but I'm curious what your thoughts are and how you tell the story of a civil rights movement that's so disparate and has so many different pieces and leaders.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good question. And I mean, I tried to give proper place to the others in the movement as they were part of the story. Like Fred Shuttlesworth, and he was the guy who got King to come into Birmingham in the 63, and a lot of the other younger protesters who really were biting at King's heels and were in essence pushing him forward. So my interest was really in the dynamic and the relationship between the young and the others and King, but my interest also was in the relationship between Kennedy and King. And I do feel that was really the primary focus for this particular part of the movement, because Kennedy was a man who looked toward the big names, to the icons, and he had a lot of communication, if not with him by himself directly, through his intermediaries. I mean, at one point, I think it was during the Birmingham marches, you know, they were having meetings in the White House to discuss what are they going to do next. And he had his man, Burke Marshall, running out of the room to get King on the phone and talk to him and ask King, what does King think we should be doing at this point? So King was instrumental, really, in sort of overshadowing and shadowing what was going on. And there's another element to it. And it's, you know, a lot of people don't believe in this part of history either, but I sort of do believe in the great man theory of history, which has been around and been discounted and has come back in some ways. And Kennedy himself believed in it, where, you know, you have major social trends that occur, but within those social trends, it is the great leaders who cause things to go one way or another in the end. And my feeling is, as I study this, the civil rights movement during this period in early 60s could have gone many different directions, and it went this direction largely because of these two guys and the way that they managed to deal with each other, the way that King knew to speak truth to power, the way that Kennedy responded and listened to being spoken to in that way. And from my perspective for today, I feel this is more relevant right now, because we're in an era where we're always wanting to speak truth to power, and we always need power to listen. And in some ways, I feel like these guys set a model that, even though it's 50 years old, has complete relevance today. And I'm hoping that it may permeate and have a place in the discussions of what we're witnessing.
Well, so that brings us to today, and one of the criticisms often leveled or concerns about the Black Lives Matter movement is it lacked the same kind of leader or leadership, that it didn't have that person who could transform the concerns today over policing and kind of the ongoing crisis of the cities and more in the criminal justice system translate all of that into not only a national platform, but be able to persuade our leaders, our presidents, our members of Congress, that this should matter. And you saw that in the 2016 campaign efforts to do this when speeches were interrupted, including Bernie Sanders at one point, to get this issue on the table. Do you agree with the criticism that we don't have the kind of leadership right now that you have now written about? Or is it out there? And are you more optimistic about that than some people feel?
Oh, I'm sure it's out there. It's just a matter of it's manifesting itself. But I think there's a major difference, and this is what the movement today suffers from, and that is the times are so different. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really can't expect to have the kind of experience that King and Kennedy had 50 years ago today, because as we know, just the technological and the media environment is so different. In those days, you know, the media environment was much more concentrated, and so King could rise because there was a very concentrated focus on him among a certain type of media, and that was the media that everyone paid attention to and listened to. Today, it's so fractured and diffuse that it's harder for an individual, I think, to rise to the top and become the one who everyone pays attention to. And this is why almost you see so much incivility out there, is because people who want to rise know that they can only rise by garnering attention that sometimes is granted them because of their incivility rather than their civility, which is what we had 50 years ago.
It's funny because some of the challenges facing movement leaders are the same kind of challenges presidents face, meaning that, you know, like King, President Kennedy had the ability to command large audiences quickly. If you were watching television and he spoke, that's what you had to watch. And media wasn't fractured along partisan lines. And so people make a similar argument with the bully pulpit in the presidency that I think is probably, as you say, a challenge that movement and others beyond the president face in the current environment as well.
Yeah, I also think that the partisanship of today is really keeping people from moving forward on this. In those days, even though the Kennedy and King eras were extremely difficult and fractious, and there was a sense that there could never be a meeting of the minds, from my understanding and from what I know, some of it's in the book, even the people who were most segregationist knew that this couldn't last, knew that if they wanted to push the country forward socially, economically, things had to change, and they were willing to make some compromises, and that's really what happened. There were compromises that were made even before legislation. Today, it just feels like that feeling, that sentiment of wishing for compromise for the progress of all seems to have been abandoned.
Well, I hope we're out of time, but I do hope people can take a look at this book. I think it's really a wonderful look at the ways in which different kinds of leadership not only matters, but how leaders can transform, certainly in the past, to better places, and often how presidents can transform because of what social movements do. I think that's an important story. So I just want to urge everyone to pick up a copy or order a copy of Stephen Levinston's Kennedy and King, The President, the Pastor, and the Battle Over Civil Rights, which is just a wonderful piece of history, a terrific read, and has many important lessons for today. Thanks for joining the show.
Oh, thank you so much.
And that's it for the show. We'll be back soon on Politics and Polls. This is Julian Zelizer, and look forward to talking again.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.